On this week's 51%, there's help for very low birth weight premature babies, and an artist brings awareness to street harassment.
You know, street harassment isn't just sexism.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Children's Hospital at Westchester Medical Center in New York has a first-of-its-kind facility to process preterm human milk for extreme low birth weight babies. I spoke with the head of the new donor milk bank at the hospital in Valhalla. Maria Ferrari Children's Hospital's donor milk program provides human milk for preterm babies born at 28 weeks or earlier and who weigh less than 2.2 pounds, as well as to ill infants. Dr. Boriana Parvez is a neonatologist at the Children's Hospital and director of the new specialized program for so-called micro-preemies.
In 2015, we eliminated the use of formula among premature babies and very critically ill babies. And so all our patients became exclusively human milk fed. This produced amazing results. There was a reduction of necrotizing enterocolitis by 70%. Necrotizing enterocolitis is a devastating disease which affects premature infants. It's a severe inflammation of the small intestines. The risk of developing this disease is much higher if a baby receives formula rather than human milk. And it may be associated with a 50% mortality. So then we don't notice that the babies who are receiving donor milk are not growing as fast as babies who are previously receiving formula feeding as a supplement to their mother's milk or as a full nutrition. In generally, it is a well-recognized fact that babies who are breastfed, full-term babies who are breastfed, grow at a slower pace. And this is probably a good thing because breastfed babies are known to have lower incidence of diabetes, obesity, high blood pressure once they reach adulthood. But for premature babies, we were concerned that maybe that's not a good thing because premature babies' bodies are growing. They need to significantly increase the size of their brains. And we were concerned that maybe this growth, slower growth, may adversely affect their neurodevelopmental outcome. Then we thought that full-term milk, donor milk from community-based milk bank, has the composition that of macronutrients that is probably insufficient for our premature infants. Interestingly, the breast milk of a full-term mom, meaning mom who delivered the baby at term, has lower protein and lower calories than the breast milk of a mom who delivered a premature baby. It seems that the body of a premature mom knows that her baby needs more nutrition. Also, people have shown that the protective factors, anti-immunologic factors in the breast milk of a premature mom are higher than a full-term mom. And so we thought then we need to then collect milk from moms who have abundant supply but who also had delivered premature babies. And definitely there are at any given moment, there are at least 2 to 3 mothers who have abundant milk supply, premature mothers who have abundant milk supply.
Right. So clearly they can produce enough for themselves, you know,
for their own babies, right, and they have another. Some extra
got
to
it,
spare.
Got it.
Then we actually conducted a little survey in the unit asking all the mothers in the unit 2 questions. If you have abundant milk supply, would you be willing to share your milk with other mothers and other babies? And the second question was, if your milk supply was insufficient, would you accept a donated milk from another mother? obviously as cream milk and processed milk, pasteurized milk. Interestingly, all the mothers that we approached about donating their milk said yes, overwhelmingly yes. So preemie moms definitely wanted to help other preemie moms. When we asked the question whether they will accept donated milk for their own babies, they had a lot more questions. They wanted to know about the safety of the milk. They wanted to know where the milk is coming from. They wanted to know whether it's going to cost them extra money, and so forth. But
sure, I would expect that.
Yeah. You expect that. Then we estimated, based on the breastfeeding rates, based on the number of premature babies, the amount of milk that we'll be needing. And then we began building up a preterm milk bank. This is a very unique program. There is no such milk bank in the country. There are a few hospital-based milk banks. So the location of our milk bank is not unique, but the fact that we are collecting, processing, and distributing premature donor milk is the most unique aspect of our program. The more premature the baby, the higher the macronutrient content. So we are focusing, really collecting milk from moms who had micropreemies or babies who were born with a birth weight. Their own babies are with a birth weight below 2 pounds.
To boost the growth of premature infants, the Liquid Gold Preemie Donor Milk Bank at the Children's Hospital analyzes and enriches human milk to the exact nutritional needs of each premature infant. Dr. Parvez hopes the new program cuts the rate of the severe intestinal disease, or NEC, further, or even eliminates it. And she is conducting research on another complication seen in premature babies.
We have observed another very interesting phenomenon, which no one has reported until now. Ever since we implemented the exclusive human milk diet in our premature patient population, we observed a significant decrease in another very severe complication of prematurity. That is called intraventricular hemorrhage, or IVH. The rate of severe IVH in extremely premature babies is around 10%. And severe IVH is associated definitely with neurodevelopmental deficits long-term. So right now, we have a manuscript in preparation. We show that there is a reduction of severe IVH down to 4%. So obviously, we want to sustain this health benefits. And the next focus will be to optimizing the growth of this baby. So I'm thinking that our hope is that as we primarily utilize premature donor milk from our milk bank, especially in the first most critical period of premature baby's course in the NICU, that their growth will be improved. And we'll be watching these patients in our neonatal follow-up program, which is a very robust program here in the Lower Hudson Valley. We'll be watching their development until at least 3 years of age. And we'll be able to compare neurodevelopmental outcome of these infants before the beginning of our premature donor milk program and milk bank functioning and after.
In addition to improving the health of extreme premature babies, there could be a major cost savings.
One case of necrotizing enterocolitis costs about $300,000. And necrotizing enterocolitis is not only an acute disease that requires surgery, requires longer hospital stay, but also impacts baby's neurodevelopment. So if children have, and also their ongoing gastrointestinal health, so some of these children may be life-dependent as a result of this disease to parental oral nutrition or IV nutrition. Many of them require long-term rehab services, early intervention services, or long-term chronic care facility services. And that costs sometimes is estimated in the range of $1.2 million per baby for a lifetime.
Maria Ferrari Children's Hospital's Isaac and Naomi Kaplan Family Regional Neonatal Intensive Care Unit cares for more than 700 neonatal patients each year, about 150 of whom are born at less than 3 pounds.
This is Bird Note. For 20 years, Charlotte Getcha studied the cerulean warblers that breed in the mountains near Asheville, North Carolina. Sadly, over the past 50 years, their numbers have declined by more than 70%. To understand why, Charlotte began recording the singing of breeding males.
It's absolutely fascinating because I can distinguish almost always the different males and can even tell when I have a bird up there who has returned from the previous year. And the fact that they are declining dramatically makes it even more important to understand their habitat requirements.
Charlotte provides her findings to the National Park Service and to Audubon, North Carolina.
I think people all over the United States can get more active in conserving birds of all kinds by working with their Audubon societies.
To find your local Audubon, visit audubon.org/chapters. BirdNote celebrates the efforts of our listeners and the work of our partners, such as Audubon, to conserve birds and the environment we share. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein.
Every day, all over the world, women young and old, of different body types, queer and straight, dressed for work or a night on the town, are catcalled and denigrated simply for walking down the street. It's a form of street harassment, and it's something Tatiana Fazlalizadeh wants to stop. So she uses her street art portraits to explore how women of all backgrounds experience daily hostility in public spaces. Fazlalizadeh is a classically trained oil painter, and she turned to street art in 2012 to highlight the issue she felt was being overlooked. Her artwork became the project Stop Telling Women to Smile, in which she speaks with women about harassment, fear, and empowerment. In her debut book, Stop Telling Women to Smile, Stories of Street Harassment and How We're Taking Back Our Power, Fazlalizadeh profiles 10 women of various backgrounds and locations. The 34-year-old says it was her own experiences of harassment and empowerment that inspired her to start the project 8 years ago.
Stop Telling Women to Smile began in 2012 when I was living in Philadelphia and I was working as a mural artist in Philadelphia. And I had the idea to combine my experiences with street harassment, which was something that happened to me very often in Philadelphia when I moved there at 17. Combining street harassment with street art, you know, it just sort of made sense to me. As I was experiencing street harassment and as I was working as a public artist, I just sort of got the idea to kind of combine those two things together. And that's really how Stop Telling to Smile was created. I came up with a few different designs and started wheat pasting them, and it sort of grew from there. It wasn't actually titled Stop Telling to Smile in the beginning. I didn't have a name for it. It was something I was experimenting with, and the project itself just sort of like grew out of these, you know, designs that I was putting up in the street and these experiences that I was having and talking to other people. And it was sort of like a project just kind of came together after a while. But the original intent was to address street harassment through public art.
Is there a significance behind the design that you chose, that clear-cut pencil portrait with the bold type underneath it?
Yeah. So, you know, in the earlier designs, I wasn't using the drawings. I was sort of playing around just with text and type, maybe kind of like combining them with photographs. It wasn't until later that I decided I should draw these images of women. I should draw their portraits. I've always been a portrait artist. I have mostly worked in oil and pencil. And so I didn't want to necessarily lose that I wanted to have that as a part of this. And so I eventually landed on these graphite drawings of women. When I started putting them in the street, I just really loved the way that they sort of stood out against the colored texture of the world. And you have these very simple, beautiful black and white drawings. So it took me a little bit to get to that. Like, it took me a few kind of concepts and designs to get to the final image that we know of and see now. But I really love the way that I sort of landed on these drawings.
You're coming up on 8 years with this project. How has it changed over time?
So it's changed pretty drastically from the beginning. You know, the beginning, I was very much so talking about my own personal experiences with street harassment. I was looking at what I go through, what I've been through, and putting that into artwork and putting it outside. Over the years, you know, it's grown into me talking and interviewing and including the stories of dozens and dozens and dozens of women, non-binary folks, really from kind of across the US, but also in other countries as well. So, you know, that alone has changed me personally, my understanding of street harassment, my understanding of the way that people's bodies are consumed out in the world, and the different ways that that happens and the different ways that that looks. And so taking that information and combining it into the artwork. So it's no longer just my project about my experience. It's something that includes the stories of so many other people. And it's also grown in that, you know, it's more of a collaborative project now. People all over the world have access to the posters. They have access to be able to like download the work and go out in the street and put it up themselves. The work has been put up in cities that I've never even been to before, you know, because other people are now kind of like taking on the project as their own and going out in the street and doing it too.
Have you seen any changes in how women are speaking about their experiences of harassment and fear and empowerment since your project started to post Me Too?
I think one of the main things that I've seen is just the sheer amount of people sharing their stories and being very loud and being vocal about what happens to them. You know, when I first started this project, I, even myself, you know, didn't really talk about street harassment at all, really. I talked about it with my friends. I would vent to them about, you know, what was happening, and they would do the same with me. But I didn't really see this sort of larger national conversation around it. And I think social media has a lot to do with that. Technology has a lot to do with it. Though it is, the sight of it is in the street, the artwork is, it also very much lives online and has a very online presence in life. And I think that's where a lot of the conversation is happening and where a lot of people feel like they are able to tell their stories and be vocal about their experiences. And so I see that, you know, in the context of my project, but also in the larger context of Me Too. And I think really just in kind of like social justice movements in the last few years as a whole, I think people are just feel like they now have the space, whether that's online in a person, and they have the agency and they have the backing of other people, which, you know, helps amplify their own voices. So that's, I think, the biggest change that I've seen.
Was it the internet that led you down to Mexico City, or was it just something that you wanted to do looking at the news stories coming out of Mexico City?
Well, Mexico City was, in Mexico City and like other cities that I've been to outside of the U.S. to do the project, I've also been to Paris to do the work. Those sort of happened in collaboration with other people. So when I went to Mexico City, I was working with Fusion, a digital site, to do this project there. And so I had a lot of resources as far as like meeting with folks and creating the work and putting the work up. You know, there was a big group of us that went. And when we decided to go to Mexico City, it was because we were sort of looking at the places, looking at the cities that sort of had a record of being very hostile towards women, of having, you know, a lot of sexual harassment cases and experiences and street harassment experiences. You know, talking with folks, thinking about what city we should go to, and Mexico City was one of the ones that came up. And so we went there and very much so felt like this work will be good here. And that was because the women that came out and spoke to me, I had a big group discussion. I think 20, 30, 40 women came and we all spoke about their experiences with street harassment. And they were very enthused, very eager to not just talk about it, but to do something about it, to take some action against street harassment. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that I love about this work is that, you know, I'm creating space for people to talk about their experiences with street harassment. But beyond that, we are taking steps to actually try to do something about it, to physically go out in the street with a piece of artwork as a tool to try to challenge, you know, these experiences. And so Mexico City was great for that because all of the women that I spoke to were angry and they were ready to do something. And I felt like the work was very useful to them. So I was very happy that it could be.
How did you decide what women to profile in your book?
So for the book, I spoke with a good number of people. I usually put out an open call, or I will, you know, seek out certain types of folks, certain groups, certain organizations to hear particular stories. For this book, though, I sort of just put out an open call for people, really anyone, to come talk to me and tell me about their experiences so that I can make new work for the project. You know, the work that we see in the book and the women that I talk to in the book and non-binary people that I talk to in the book, it's not just for the book. So the work is also a part of the project. And those posters are now out in the streets and they'll continue to be out in the streets that I made from their stories. And so the stories that, you know, we see in the book and read about in the book are from folks who I thought had very particular and interesting stories and experiences and things that I hadn't talked about before in the project. What's great about the book is that it's an extension of the project, and we're talking and hearing from all new folks that I'd never talked to or stories that I'd never told before in the series previous to the book. So we're looking at things like fat phobia, transphobia, race, gentrification, immigration, all types of things that I think are relevant to a lot of women and non-binary people today and now, and that I hadn't really touched on before the book. You know, I wanted the book to be sort of refreshing, and that here are new stories, here are very particular stories, here's how they fit into the larger conversation around street harassment. And so that's how I decided on the folks that are in the book now, just people who I thought had really particular and interesting perspectives on street harassment.
You not only profile in your book, but you also offer solutions. How do we make the streets safer for women?
I think one of the main things is hearing and listening to women. I think it kind of starts there. I think storytelling is very important when it comes to activism, just hearing what people go through and believing them and understanding that this is something that happens and validating that experience and saying, I hear you and I believe you. And I think once we do that, we'll have a better understanding of what's actually happening. You know, street harassment isn't just sexism. There's a lot of other stuff that's happening with street harassment. There's violence. There's, you know, the issues of race. There's the issues of class. There's all of these things that are happening. And so if we have a good understanding of that, and we're hearing a lot of different stories and narratives and complicating the issues, then I think it makes it that much easier to be able to look at it and then decide what to do about it. And then I think from there, it's the actual stopping of it. It's stopping this behavior. It's calling men out. It's holding them accountable. It's saying, this is what happens to me. Do not do this to me anymore. It's bringing a lot of other people into the conversation, men, women, non-binary people, children, everyone, to be like, this is what's going on and let's stop it. And then there's the actual real life. What do I do to stop this if I see it and I'm walking down the street? So there's things like bystander intervention. You know, there are groups in Brooklyn who go out and do bike patrols just to make sure that women, you know, are being treated safely in the streets. So there are a number of different actual real life solutions that can happen. But I think it really starts with saying, this is what's happening. Let's stop it. You know, we can't act like this is something that is acceptable anymore, that's normalized anymore, because it has been normalized. And I think that's why it's taking so long for us to stop street harassment, is because it's just seen as a thing that women just have to go through, right? It's just something that's a part of our lives. It's fine. Just take it as a compliment. We have to undo that. We have to undo that normalization of it, I think, in order for it to actually get some real life consequences and stop.
What do you think would happen if women told men to smile?
You know, I think at first they probably, I'm not sure. I mean, that's a good question. I think, you know, eventually they would not like it. What's happening when you tell someone to smile is you are imposing your wants and desires for that person to look a certain way for you. And I think it's so easy for us to do that to women, because women are We've been socialized to, you know, be pleasant and nice and sweet all of the time. We can't have any other range of emotions. And so to turn that back onto men, I think would be an interesting experiment to tell them and to try to force our ideas onto how they should appear onto them. We don't have any sort of requirements of cis hetero men to look and be a certain way for our enjoyment, for the enjoyment of other people.
How has this project changed you personally as an artist?
This project has changed me personally as an artist. I think I'm I think I'm more empathetic. I'm interested in really diving deeply into how we treat other people and how people are treated in their everyday lives, and taking a very close look at those seemingly small, trivial actions and interactions that we go through every day that really do have a mental, emotional, economical, you know, financial, all types of different effects and impact on our actual lives. How is telling a woman to smile really affecting her life? How is being followed around in a store if you're a Black person or a person of color and being criminalized in that way? A seemingly small way, a seemingly small thing, right? How do I take that and actually shine a light on it and pinpoint it and say, this is actually an example of a larger issue and is actually having a real impact on people's lives. I think that's one of the main things that I've gotten from this project when it comes to myself and my artwork. And, you know, personally, it's also, I think it's made me bolder. It's made me want to be a lot more loud in what I go through simply as a human being and being very vocal about that and amplifying my own story, because I realize that when you do that, you sort of allow other people the space to do the same thing by saying it's okay to talk about these things that seem to be trivial in your life. They aren't. You should actually tell your story very loud and very vibrantly, because in doing so, you're also telling other people's stories and allowing them the space to tell theirs.
That was 51%'s Elizabeth Hill speaking with Tatiana Fazlalizadeh about her book, Stop Telling Women to Smile, Stories of Street Harassment and How We're Taking Back Our Power. The book is out February 4th. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1592.